longer and longer things. And I guess when we were working together, oh my God, it was the end of the 70s. I was writing short stories. I hadn't even started writing my first novel.
So then how did that happen? How did you come to know that you could write long?
I think what happened was that I just started, what I was writing page by page began to get longer and longer. After I stopped writing poems, when I stopped writing poems, I felt like I came to a just dead halt and did nothing for a while. The wish to write, it was still in me, but it was sort of like a lot of water ran down a drain, and there was just the empty drain there for a while. And then I thought, I would like to write a story rather than a poem, and the story was very short. And then the story I wrote after that was a little longer, and the one after that was a little longer still. And they just kept getting longer and longer. And then I realized, as I had realized that I would always rather read fiction than poetry, though I also, there's some poetry I love, and it is more important to me than anything. But generally speaking, picking something up to read, I would rather read fiction than poetry. And then I also realized, well, reading fiction, I would rather read, generally speaking, again, a novel than a short story. So, you know, going on the really great advice that Seymour Glass gives Buddy Glass and Seymour, that you should write what you really want to read, I thought, I'm going to write a novel. And I don't want to write anything else, even though I think my novels are sort of, they're all a little anomalous as novels, but they're novels, and I really like having all that room to move around in.
Mm-hmm. Well, your fiction, your novels, because I've kind of kept track of you since I left Vermont, and with each book, your novels have definitely a poetic quality. I mean, you have brought poetry to your fiction.
Yeah, I've always been really interested in, you know, language, and what I've come to realize as I continue writing, as I become, as you do, more and more aware of what it is you really can do and want to do, that when I'm writing something long, the way I perceive the transitions between the parts has very little to do with logic or plot, and has everything to do with my ear and a sense that what I'm really doing is, what I imagine a composer would be doing, composing a piece of music, where you hear the way a particular section ends, and then you know the way the next section is going to have to sound for them to work okay together. And I think that's probably more like a poet thinking than, more like a poet or like a poet. There are a lot of novelists, I think, who probably also function that way, but certainly there's that application of the ear and the sound of the language that's always really been important to me.
Interesting. You are listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Catherine Davis, author of The Thin Place, published by Little Brown. So then how does, say, plot outlining, how does all that figure in? Where do you begin? Where do you begin with your books?
Well, I can talk right now about where I am with what I want to do next, which is in a sort of nowhere place, but where I'm beginning to collect pieces that I know are going to be pieces of what the next book will consist of. So And I do. I want to talk about plot, but I'm not going to talk about that right now. So don't let me forget. I want to talk about that.
Okay.
But just like the way I begin, usually, first, I don't want whatever I write next to be like what I wrote the last time. I don't want to just repeat myself. And though I know I have certain concerns that keep cropping up, and I know there's a way I write sentences that probably is, you know, idiosyncratic to me, I don't want it to be the same. So that's a really important consideration. And then equally important is figuring out where I want to be spending, you know, a couple of years, 3 years, 4 years in my imagination working on a book. So there's some quality of place that is crucial to me to figure out where I want to be. And until I figure that out, nothing else makes any sense to me. I might think, like with the walking tour, I wanted to have a story with two couples where the husbands were in business together. I knew I wanted to do that, and I was, you know, thinking actually about the lives of some people I knew and wanting to imaginatively reflect on what that would be like. But until I knew that I could put them in Wales, I found the thinking I was doing about it boring. It made me restless. So I have to figure that piece out. But while I'm figuring out the piece about where it's going to happen, I'm also beginning to be obsessed with some characters. And usually there's a phrase or two that's just running around and around in my head that I can't get to quiet down. I don't have anything like an overall view of the plot at the beginning. It's just a bunch of like things you'd throw into a pot when you're making soup, and they're all just bubbling around, and they haven't begun to look like they have anything to do with one another yet.
So then what is the process? I mean, do you allow yourself to write, to develop the characters and see where it leads you, and at some point it must gel?
Yeah, I the last two books, with Versailles and with The Thin Place, I had pretty early on, with Versailles it was easy because once I knew I wanted to talk about Marie Antoinette, it was as if there was a pre-existing story. So I didn't have to worry about that there. I had to worry about a lot of other things. But with The Thin Place, I also had some idea from the outset of what the overall arc of the book was going to be. And that's not always the case. I mean, I don't think that's going to be the case with my next book. I don't think, so far at least, I'm not seeing the whole shape of it with blinding clarity. So what I've been doing is, I'm working regularly, writing little bits and pieces, but until I begin to see how they connect to one another or cohere, I won't really feel like I'm in the thick of the writing of it. And then once that happens, all the while I'm writing notes on index cards, which I just put into a cigar box. I'm not very organized at all. And the idea of doing something like an outline is so frightening to me. I remember having to do them in elementary school, and they always made me feel depressed, like everything you were going to do was preordained, so why even bother to do it? So I still feel that way. Like, I just want to be feeling my way through the book. But at some point, to be, you know, honest about it early on, I begin to see the shape of the whole book. It's not as if I'm working blind from beginning to end. But I never write down what I'm going to do. It's in my head, and I'll make notes to myself, and the notes go on the index cards, and the index cards go in the cigar box, and then periodically I rummage around in it.
I like that.
Rummage around in the cigar box for these pieces of paper, not unlike, now I will say to your listeners who listen to you all the time, the way you wrote the fortunes that went into the fortune cookies.
Oh, that's right.
That you made for the Halloween party we had.
That's right.
That I have really never forgotten. Do you remember that?
I remember the party. I don't remember the fortunes, though.
You made fortune cookies from scratch, Barbara.
That's right.
And
interesting.
And you wrote the fortunes. And the only fortune I remember, but it's really like what I do with these index cards. It's something like a surprise.
Mm-hmm.
And it keeps you surprised while you're working. And the fortune I remember was, I think we had all just seen The Children of Paradise and been completely knocked out by it. And so one of the fortunes said, "Garance, Garance," which is like that mm-hmm. impassioned exclamation at the end of the movie. Do you remember?
Yeah, now I do. Now I do.
Anyway, so see, you taught me how to do the index cards.
That's really interesting. I didn't. Well, I remember, you know, I remember in working with you that you did really encourage just seeing what came out. And that was, for me, freeing, because I have never understood outlining. And the best I can do is maybe if I really have something I have to know something about, usually it's something nonfiction, that I draw pictures, you know.
Oh, that's great.
Because I can't do this outlining. But in fiction, yeah, it seems to me, because I did outline a book once, and after I was done, I had no interest in writing the book.
It's no, like, what's I can't the point? Imagine being interested in doing something after you've outlined it.
I know so many writers that do, and especially mystery writers, where plot is such a big deal.
Well, of course, a mystery writer would do that. And in my, you know, my secret heart of hearts, you know, there's a place where I sort of wish that I was a mystery writer. Just, I wish I had a detective, and I was just writing a series of mystery books, and I could plot them all out. I mean, that sounds like a really wonderful life to me, actually. It sounds, when I think about it, it seems very relaxing. I would love to hear what the mystery writers would say. But, of course, you'd have to plot it out because, I mean, you really do need to know what you're doing. And I guess because there's a part of me that loves to read detective fiction, which I read obsessively, when I write, in a way, I also want to be writing some version of a mystery novel. One of the forms that helps me understand to do what I do when I'm plotting is the mystery, where you're picking up clues, you're encouraged to want to keep turning pages because something has happened and you wonder what it has to do with some bigger picture.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, you know, what a mystery writer does. The part of mysteries I've never actually liked ever is the part at the end where, you know, they all gather in the drawing room and the detective mm-hmm. explains exactly what happened. And that's always just, even if I don't know what the answer is, I just find that so disappointing and boring. So I've never wanted to do that part. I thought, okay, I'll just write the mystery books, but I won't have the explanation at the end, which I know has made people occasionally very cross with my books.
It's true, though, because that can be the part of a mystery or suspense novel that seems the most contrived.
Yeah.
When you have to just tie it all up as if things ever are really all tied up.
Exactly. Exactly.
And I think that that's such a strength of your writing, is that you end in a satisfying way, but it's not necessarily neat and, you know, tied up in that way, contrived.
Well, I really, that's nice to hear, because, I mean, that's, you know, what you want to do. I mean, you want people to feel satisfied, but not as if, you know, all the crumbs have been dusted off the table and the napkins folded up and that's it. I don't want that. But it's hard. I think ending things is very hard. I think ending, especially novels, you know, it's not always easy to end them in a way that's satisfying. And
well, in The Thin Place ends with such a beautiful last paragraph that I guess we can't give it away. But let me ask you this then. How did that come to you? Did you labor over this ending? Do you just really, is this one of the places where you revise and revise until it's just right? Or do your endings, did this ending in The Thin Place just come?
The ending of The Thin Place, I knew, it's weird actually. I knew from, I don't know, like maybe two-thirds of the way in where, you know, first the sound, to go back to that thing about my ears, like the sound of what I wanted it to be like. And then I actually knew pretty much, you know, where, with what characters and with what sort of words I wanted to end. And then I knew the exact words, and I wrote them down. And that was before I even got there.
Mm.
It was trickier doing some of the stuff sort of immediately preceding that. And all this sounds very coy because, of course, I don't want to say exactly what happens at the end. Because I do think the
right.
book is, it seems to me it's, of all the books I've written, it's maybe more suspenseful than some of them. So I wouldn't want to, you know, give up the plot. But I knew which characters I wanted to be ending on and the feeling I wanted it to have there.
Mm.
So I was sort of working towards that.
Yeah. Well, we have so much more to talk about, and when we return, I'd love you to read to us. So all of you out there, don't go anywhere. We will be right back with more Catherine Davis, author of The Thin Place. Stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Darling, one month built in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
none of those stations playing them and ask why. In fact, where are those stations today? Somebody better ask somebody that. The people that's most affected by this war.
From animal rights and the anti-war movement to civil disobedience and culture jamming, Justice or Just Us examines law, equality, public policy, and social activism. Tune in Thursdays 8 to 9 a.m. on KUCI in Irvine and KUCI.org.
Weekly Signals, every Tuesday morning from 8 to 9 a.m. Join me, Mike Hasper, and Nathan Callahan for the best in reality-based radio. That's Weekly Signals. Check out the website at weeklysignals.com.
Listen to Writers on Writing, hosted by Barbara DeMarco Barrett on Thursdays at 5 p.m. on KUCI FM in Irvine. Bye-bye.
The opinions and views expressed in this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM 88.9. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus. We're also on the web at KUCI.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. We are also podcasting these days, and the shows are being archived on my website, which is penonfire.com. Go to penonfire.com, click on the radio tower. It will bring you to the radio page, and it's pretty self-explanatory from there. You will see a little link to podcasting and archiving and all that. This show will go up probably next week. So it's wonderful. We have not quite 36 shows up, which means some of them are our shows with two guests. Some of them are our shows with one guest. So there's a lot of listening to be done at that place. Speaking of a place, we have Catherine Davis with us, author of The Thin Place, published by Little Brown. We've been with Catherine since 5 o'clock Pacific time, and here she is again. Hello there.
Hi. You know, I was just listening to you talking there and thinking how, you know, a person's voice, I guess until we get really old, like our voices, they stay the same. And listening to your voice, I was really remembering, you know, you and me talking when we were both a whole lot younger, when I was, you know, teaching you a million years ago at Goddard College. But your voice is still the same voice, so then I'm conjuring up your face. And this is maybe not so interesting to your listeners, but it certainly is to me.
Well, you sound the same, too, and I was wondering. I was also wondering, because voices change, and and you sound the same, which is...
Yeah, I mean, great. I remember how we used to talk and talk and talk, and so this had the sort of same feeling. In fact, it was really weird, because here we are, and I have this phone, you know, against my ear, and I'm talking, and because I'm talking on the phone and I'm talking to you, I sort of forgot that I was talking on the radio. I mean, it just seemed like the way we used to talk a really long time ago. So I hope I haven't said anything, you know, I shouldn't have.
I think you're fine.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Yeah, it does. That does happen, I think, on this show. I think I was telling you before we went on that that's what I like about it, is that it's just a conversation. I think that's what listeners like, too, that it's that. And sometimes people do forget, though.
Yeah, you do. I mean, it's not formal. And at some point, my dog might start howling. But, you know, that'll...
It's all right. We like dogs. We like dogs a lot. Before we let the half go by without you reading, I would love if you would read from The Thin Place.
Shall I just... What if I read the little opening chapter?
Sure.
Okay.
And again, if you just tuned in, we're with Catherine Davis, author of The Thin Place, published by Little Brown. She's going to read.
Okay, this is the very opening, and it's the book is in short chapters, so this is the first chapter, which is not all that long. there were three girlfriends, and they were walking down a trail that led to a lake. One small and plump, one pretty and medium-sized, one not so pretty and tall. This was in the early years of the 21st century. The unspeakable having happened so many times, everyone was still in shock, still reeling from what they'd seen, what they'd done or failed to do. The dead souls no longer wore gowns. They'd gotten loose, broadcasting their immense soundless cord through the precincts of the living. At the lake, the trail branched left and right. Right to the town beach, a grassy plot with six picnic tables, two stone grills, a pit toilet, a trash can, and a narrow strip of lumpy gray sand. Left to the knoll, where the overlarge houses of the rich nestled among shade trees and tasteful redwood play structures, and then back to town. Straight ahead was the boat ramp and the Crockett's chocolate lab buddy going down shoulder first on a dead fish. Beyond the ramp was the water. The sky was the palest blue and fluttered over the girls' heads like a circus tent at the apex of which the sun was pinned. It was a Saturday in mid-May, the sun only just starting to heat up, it being the northern latitudes. But even so, Mrs. Kipp had made sure they all wore sunblock. You couldn't be too careful. Like many objects of worship, the sun had grown impatient with its worshippers, causing some of them to sicken and die. As she larded on the sunblock, Mrs. Kipp informed them that these days only stupid people had tans. When they got to the beach, the three girls came to a halt. A very large man dressed in a pair of khaki shorts and not much else was lying on his stomach in the sand with his head facing the lake. From where the girls stood, they could see the bottoms of the man's feet, which looked smooth and white. Almost as if he were a baby, observed Lorna Fine, not only the tallest and least attractive, but also the most fanciful of the three. The older Lorna got, the prettier she would become, but for now, she was like a bespectacled monkey wearing red and yellow plaid seersucker pants and the vintage Ramones t-shirt she'd found in the back of her brother's closet under a stack of dirty magazines, so she was sure he wouldn't ask for it back. Sonny Crockett let out a loud sigh Lorna knew was meant to be overheard by anyone inconsiderate enough to be hogging the entire strip of sand when obviously there were other people who wanted to use it. "It's Mr. Banner," said Mies Kipp. "Who?" Lorna asked. "Mr. Banner," said Mies, "from Sonny's church." She walked around to the man's right, where she planted herself, a small round thing in a pink tracksuit, in the sand next to his face. Mr. Banner's eyes were loosely shut, and his black eyeglasses were shoved up, so the left lens was wedged over the bridge of his nose, which was bruised and bleeding. His mouth was partly open, and a little foamy drool was coming out of it. There were several black fly bites, the first of the season, on his bald head, and four long, fine hairs were growing out of the middle of his nose, halfway between the bridge and the nostrils. Noon. The sun shone down. Mies leaned closer. Mr. Banner smelled like perspiration, but also sweet like cotton candy. And there was something about him, about the way he lay there, so perfectly still, yet with a sense of something enormously alive inside him, something almost insanely teeming with slumberous, hidden vitality deep inside that made her feel like she was looking at a cave full of sleeping bats. "Don't," said Lorna, when Mies reached out a finger. "Don't touch him." "Germs?" guessed Sonny, but Lorna, a great fan of Agatha Christie, shook her head. "I don't think he's breathing," she said. "Look at his chest." Tentatively, she held her hand near the man's nose. "I think he's dead." The sand was coarse and gritty, the entire beach hard as a rock. If there were any footprints, Lorna couldn't make them out, though despite the trash can, there was a lot of trash on the ground, including cigarette butts and a beer bottle. Molson, Canadian. "We should do something," said Sonny. "We should get help." "You get help," said Mies. "I'm staying here." "It's not like he's going anywhere," Lorna pointed out. But once Mies had made her mind up, forget it. "Just try not to touch anything," Lorna added sternly. "Okay?" Of course, Lorna knew perfectly well that the minute she and Sonny were out of sight, Mies would do just that. It had been so obvious, her hand visibly itching to touch the man's cheek. "Sure," Mies said. She nodded her small round face, a face that no doubt due to its exceptionally round dark eyes and full bow lips, its fringe of dark hair and pronounced widow's peak, tended to remind people of a pansy. Such a sweet little flower with such a fierce expression. "Mr. Banner," Mies was thinking. "Mr. Banner, Mr. Banner, Mr. Banner, Mr. Banner. Think of me." That was what Pansy said in the language of flowers.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Catherine Davis reading from The Thin Place, published by Little Brown. Oh, was that always the first chapter?
Yeah. I always work chronologically. I can't do it any other way. I mean, as disorganized as I am about, my planning for things, once I begin, I move from beginning to end chronologically. Oh, maybe every now and then I'll move some pieces around, but almost never. So that was the beginning. I knew I wanted to start with three girls finding a man who appeared to be dead on some sand. And when I first began, they were at a beach near the ocean. And then I realized that the setting for this book, that thing I talked about before, where the place has to be pinned down before I can really start to work, that a seaside town was completely wrong for this book.
Mm-hmm.
So I abandoned that. But I think I may take it up in the next book.
So place always seems to be important in your work.
Oh, it's completely. It's more important than anything. I don't think it's necessarily more important to the work itself when you read it, but the writing of it. If I don't know where I'm going to be, which is the way I am in life too. Like if I don't know where I am, I'm sort of frantic and miserable.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you're writing, even though you're sitting at a desk, you might be sitting at a desk in, for instance, St. Louis, Missouri, which is where I am right now. But if you don't know where you are in your imagination, and that's not where you are firmly lodged, for me, it's a kind of torture, and I can't think and I can't write. So I knew the features of the opening. I knew the three girls. I wanted to start with a trio of girls because I think so often there are these trios of girls in my life. I've noticed threesomes and the kind of difficulties that a threesome of girls or women can, project into their relationships.
Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Catherine Davis, author of The Thin Place. So then how do you keep track of all of the elements of your work, of the novel you're working on? I mean, as you go on, especially as, say, you're halfway through, three-quarters of the way through, is it the 3x5 cards that you go back to and look at if you have to remember what happened or what happened?
It's a really great question. And my students ask me questions like this too. I mean, questions also bred from their experience. And I think, the truth is you can't keep track of all of it. I've thought a lot about this. Like, if you could, that would be the outline method. And partly what you have to do is, is give up trying to feel like you can keep track of everything, because, you know, you can't do that in life either, and just have the feeling of striking out, like you jump into the water on the shore of a fairly wide lake, and you're going to swim to the other side, and you don't really... While you're in process, you don't know how far you are from one shore to the other, or, you know, really what you've passed over and what you're going to encounter as you continue. You just sort of have to trust that you know what you need to know to keep going. And once I realized that, it made writing novels possible in the way I wanted to write them. Because you can freak out and think, "Oh my God, what? Who is this? Who is this person I'm writing about?" I mean, there's sort of a way you can even, you know, forget that you interpose some character, and then what are you going to do with them? The way it happens in life. So I think trust is a big part of, you know. Trusting what you're doing yourself is a big part of what happens when you're writing a novel. Mm-hmm. At least for me.
Mm-hmm. And then what? How does the revision process go for you? Is that a big part of what happens after you have a draft, or are you working on it as you go along?
I do both. I mean, I work on it as I go along, but once I'm really launched, I keep moving, going on the assumption that you can't begin to revise something until you have something there to look at, some whole finished thing, and then you look at it, and then you can say, "Oh, this is the thing I made." Now, given the fact that I made this thing, you know, what is it? Because you don't, when you're writing, you don't actually know what it is that you're making. You know, you can have an idea, but if you're not working slavishly to specs, or you don't know what you're making. You really don't. Like, you could think you're going to make something that looks like, a big plate full of broccoli, and you end up with something that looks like the Venus de Milo. I mean, you just don't know. And that's when you have to revise. Because then you see, oh, this is what I was really doing, but I could make it be more this way if I got rid of this, or I added this, or I changed this. So I actually really like that part.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, what about, you know, writing what you know, taking experiences and, you know, doing what you need to do with them to make them into fiction.
Yeah. Yeah. I think probably in this last book, well, more say overtly in The Thin Place than in other books, I was using some direct experience and even some characters, some people. There are a few people who I pretty much lifted whole cloth from life and put into the book in a way I've never done before. I mean, they're good characters, so I think it's okay to say that. But I always feel like I'm using my experience and transforming it. I've never thought that writing fiction means that you can sort of hide who you are and what you've lived because you're making things up, because you are just dealing with the only stuff you have to deal with, which is, you know, the materials of your own life. And then sometimes I feel like I'm working a bigger transformation, like when I was writing about Versailles and Marie Antoinette, clearly I hadn't experienced her experience, and yet as I dug deeper and deeper into the place and the story, I began to see why it had attracted me, and a lot of it had to do with, you know, my feeling about moving around inside of a building, and also with the fact that I came to see that Marie Antoinette was in a way, you know, a whole lot like my mother. Although my mother, you know, she didn't grow up in a palace. But it's weird. I mean, you can't get away from it. So you're sort of always, there it is. It's the stuff of who you are. And then you're sort of trying to do something with it so that you're not just sort of, you know, blah, 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 like the boring person sitting beside you at the, you know, at the wedding reception. Going on and on about their life. Or, yeah. You know what I mean.
Yeah. Yeah. We have a few minutes left with Catherine Davis, author of The Thin Place. Just a few minutes. It's not enough.
Now, well, see, Barbara, we do need to talk. I'll just say this right now, right here on the air. Like, you know, we have so much catching up to do, and we're not going to do it right now on your radio show.
Yeah, especially not in the next 5 minutes.
No.
Oh, dear. Okay. Then what do the listeners want to hear here? Okay, let's do that. Well, you know, I have been wondering because, again, I recall you just being just the sort of instructor I needed, that where art was, you just sort of emanated art, you know, writing. It was more like the art of writing, not commercial writing, not, you know, how can you make a buck? It's like, how can you do your best writing? And that's the writing you should be doing, and without thought to the marketplace. And I have always appreciated that because it you know, for whether that's helped me in my later life sell my writing, I'm not sure about that. But so, you know, I guess that just leads into a question of how do you teach writing? How do you do that? I mean, and can you? I mean, it's craft, it's art, it's all of that.
Well, what you just said, which I have to say I really loved hearing, I mean, I think that continues to be my approach. I don't think that you can teach anybody to be a writer. I mean, not that, you know, we're born writers, but I think you can teach anybody to be a much better reader and a much better writer, and those two things go together and have to do with what I think is, you know, one of the reasons we are lucky to be living beings on the planet, which is we get to read things that are amazing, and sometimes, you know, we might be lucky enough to be a writer who writes something that other people would want to read. But if I can get a student to read, I don't know, I've just been thinking about that new translation of Anna Karenina, which I think is a great book, and, you know, to read it and see that, oh my God, we are living human beings on the planet, and we get to read this. In a way, that is what I really, really want to teach literature students and writing students. And for the writing student, it should then become a part of their sense of, you know, their own exhilarated mission when they're writing, which I don't think has anything to do with the marketplace. I mean, I'm sorry that there is such a thing, and I'm sorry we even have to think about it. But, you know, I just think, just like when I'm listening to great music, I think sometimes, even if the world sucks, there are horrible things happening, oh my God, I'm listening to this music. I can't imagine anything better than the fact that I'm able to be doing this. And I sort of want a student to feel that way about what they read, and then that should infuse them with a kind of passion for what they write. And that's it. That's it.
Yeah, well, I know that, you know, my own teaching style has been influenced so greatly by you because of, you know, that especially students worry about the market and where it's like, right, just write.
Yeah, right.
Read, write.
You know, forget the stupid market, even though, of course, you know, we really can't.
We really can't.
No.
No. What are you reading? What are you reading right now?
Right now I'm reading my student work, actually. And I just started to read, The Accidental, so I can't say anything about it.
Mm-hmm.
I read maybe, I don't know, 5 pages. It seemed very gripping, and I'm certainly going to continue to read. And before that, I read the new mystery by P.D. James, The Lighthouse. And before that, I reread Bleak House. So I'm sort of all over the place.
Mm.
What are you reading right now?
What am I reading right now? Well, I just finished Catherine Davis's The Thin Place. And I also just read T. Jefferson Parker's new suspense novel, The Fallen, because he's on next week, and he actually is one of my favorite suspense writers. Because
he
has a lot of literary tendencies, and I appreciate that so much about his work, that, you know, that the writing, he pays such attention to his writing.
And, yeah, I think that's really important, that it's not just sloppy.
Yeah, or just slapped together, because this is what a suspense novel is. Or,
right.
Or a mystery, as we were talking about.
Right.
We are at the end of our time. Oh, my goodness. Any last words for the writers listening who are struggling through a project? Anything?
What? Wait, what?
I said any last words.
Oh, last words. I'm sorry. My phone made a funny noise. Maybe somebody's trying to call. So I missed hearing what you said there. Last words for struggling writers.
Yeah.
I'd say just, you know, keep reading and keep writing. I mean, that's it.
Yeah, that is it.
And it's really important, because it is a struggle, to just have sort of the, you know, sort of the pack horse sensibility of just continuing and plugging along, knowing that the moments of fabulous inspiration only happen when you're slugging through the mud.
Mm. Yeah, it's true. It's true. If you wait for it.
Oh, no, you can't. That's terrible. So, and especially with, you know, long projects like novels or even short stories. Like, you just have to, day by day, step by step, trudge by trudge. Things do happen that are amazing, but you don't always know when it's happening.
Yeah.
That's what I have to say.
Mm-hmm. It's true. You don't know what's happening necessarily until time goes by and you look back at it.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you're just waiting for inspiration, it will not come. As I guess that's sort of like a watched pot never boils, mm-hmm. actually. I think it really, I hadn't thought of that before, but I think it is. It's like, if you're too attentive to something and wanting to see it happen, it's not going to happen. Mm-hmm. So you just have to plug along, and then if you're lucky, you'll be amazed.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much. It's just been a
delight.
It's
been great talking to you.
It has been. And, gosh, best of luck. Continued luck with your work and with this book. And,
well, thank you. But, you know, Barbara, I really do want to talk to you again, okay?
Okay.
I mean, I'll just say that right now on the air. Okay.
Okay. We'll do it.
Okay.
Okay. That was Catherine Davis, author of The Thin Place, published by Little Brown. A lot we didn't get to, this beautiful cover of this book. is one of those things, and so much more. Maybe when it comes out in paper or her next book, she'll come back and we'll carry on this particular conversation on the air. If you want to know more about the show, you can go to penonfire.com. You can also email me from that spot and get on my weekly email list, so I'll shoot out a message and tell you who's coming on. And I'm going to leave you with a quote by Raymond Chandler, who said, "The faster I write, the better my output. If I'm going slow, I'm in trouble. It means I'm pushing the words instead of being pulled by them." Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.